This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
That's why I call it an environmental crisis, because it's not just a technological crisis or a crisis of fossil fuels. It's a crisis of our entire civilization. It's much bigger, more daunting, more complicated, but the solution to it offers some kind of hope for the future of the human race more than any other political problem we've ever faced.
When you see someone littering a plastic bag into the street, how do you judge that person? What about the person who stands by watching the litterer and does nothing? And what about the person who supports the policymakers who want to dismantle the EPA or support other steps that undermine the health of the planet? This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome Roger Gottlieb, a philosophy professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, to discuss his new book, Morality and the Environmental Crisis. We look at the moral conundrums and the bitter divisions among this country's citizens over things as fundamental as clean air and water. Gottlieb talks about the effective ways to engage people to whom you may be diametrically opposed politically, and the intersection of religion and environmental policy. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Roger Gottlieb. He's a professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and his latest book is entitled Morality and the Environmental Crisis. Roger, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
So what is a philosophy professor writing about the environment for? Explain how these worlds have intersected in your area of study.
If you look at the environmental crisis, you see immediately two things coming into your mind. One is that we're poisoning, hurting, limiting, damaging human beings, the cancer rates, the effects of climate change, the incredible amount of pollution, the devastating effects on agriculture of both pesticides and the loss of insects. So that's bad for people, and there are moral issues connected with how bad it is for people. But we're also devastating beings who are not human. We're devastating animals in factory farms. We're devastating biodiversity. We're cutting down rainforests. We're polluting the ocean. Now, it's pretty clear in global and ethical thought from, 2,500 years ago to today, that it's wrong to hurt people unnecessarily. It's wrong to hurt people for profit. But what's wrong with cutting down trees, limiting the number of birds that live in the world, putting so much plastic in the ocean that if you cut open a dead bird on Midway Island, which is 1,500 miles from the nearest populated center, that the bird's insides are filled with bits of plastics, old cigarette lighters and bottle tops and things like that. What's wrong with that? Well, this is a classic kind of philosophical question. Is there something wrong with damaging the natural world as well as damaging people? Another issue that arises is the question of moral responsibility. In Boston, we had a few years ago what's called the marathon bombers. Some terrorists put some bombs at the end point of the marathon, killed three people, injured many, traumatized the whole city. Now, if they had put those bombs to blow up, not then, but in 10 years, they would still be terrorists. And if they took little pieces of the bombs and distributed them throughout the households of the city in ways that could damage or maybe kill or maybe just blind the population, we'd also consider them terrorists. Well, what's the moral status of people who are knowingly, willingly, for profit, increasing the level of greenhouse gases, increasing the level of global warming, or knowingly, willingly, for profit, putting poisons in the air, the water, and the food? Well, I call them a kind of war criminal, or people guilty of crimes against humanity. But again, it's another philosophical question.
Maybe you can speak towards what you see as the future role of religion when it comes to environmental policy in this country. Is it going to be a subset of every political debate we have, whether or not it's going to appeal to the evangelical wing of this country, or are we going to be able to get beyond that partisanship element ultimately? Perhaps somebody like Donald Trump, who's so out of the norm, a lot of people thought this could kind of blow up that block, but that doesn't seem to be the case, does it?
Well, he's one of the norms. Unfortunately, we're saddled with conflicting norms, and he's one of them, and hopefully others will come to the fore soon enough. I think if you want to start at the basic point, which is that religion in and of itself, I'd like to suggest, has no definite moral or political character. Religions can be progressive or they can be regressive. They can support freedom. They can support totalitarianism. If you remember Martin Luther King, letter from the Birmingham jail, well, here's Martin Luther King, a minister who was leading a civil rights movement that was led by other ministers as well. And at the same time, he got a letter from seven ministers and one rabbi telling him to slow down and don't be so eager and just don't do any civil disobedience and just kind of cool it. So there's no given single political or moral character to religion.
Religion can really be anything we want it to be in some
sense, right? That's right. That said, if you look over the last 30 years, there have been more powerful, assertive, inventive, concerned voices from the religious community than I would say practically any other single community about this issue. You can go back to 1990 with Pope John Paul II talking about the need to make nature once more the sister of humanity. You can look at tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of pamphlets the American Council of Catholic Bishops sent to every single parish in the country talking about environmental issues. You can look at the head of the World Council of Churches, which is an umbrella organization of some 400 million Protestants, who go to climate change meetings and advocate, hold on to your hat for this one, convergence, by which he meant that the average amount of greenhouse gases put out by an American should converge, should come to equal the average amount of greenhouse gases put out by, say, somebody from Bangladesh. There, I give you countless other examples, even examples from evangelical Christians. Some evangelical Christians created something called the Evangelical Environmental Network, and they talk about the responsibility of Christians to respond to climate change, that it's going to be disproportionately punishing to the poor. And they had a cavalcade several years ago called What Would Jesus Drive? And they started in Detroit, and they talked to auto manufacturers, and they went through the South talking about how the golden rule necessitates we take seriously our choices of transportation. So religious participation has certainly been far better than the American Philosophical Association, which is, as it were, my professional organization. It's certainly been a lot better than the Association of Accountants. And if you look at the history again, you'll see that in the 1990s, scientists, some rather prominent scientists, reached out to religious leaders and said, we can't do this without your help. And there have been meetings together, there have been joint proclamations, there have been press conferences, there have been letters written to the president and the Congress by joint groups of religious leaders and scientists.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Roger Gottlieb. He's a professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts, and his latest book is Morality in the Environmental Crisis. So when we look at a big idea in terms of policy, like the Green New Deal, for example, Roger, one of the issues that policymakers often choose to not include in whatever white paper they may be setting forth is trying to cut back on consumption. Because there's an ethical dilemma there from a country like America, which is consuming so much and is so used to a certain level of comforts. This is a global effort. And who are we, Americans, to say to those less fortunate in the developing world who haven't been able to benefit from the Industrial Revolution, who are we to say that the Bangladeshis cannot start having the same kind of creature comforts that we do here in America? So as a philosopher, how would you approach advising somebody crafting Green New Deal policy into something that's realistic and addresses excessive consumption?
Well, the Green New Deal is a possible proposal for fundamental shifts in American environmental policy. And as such, I think it's got a tremendous presence and a tremendous possibility, all the details to be worked out later. Of course, the great thing about the Green New Deal is that it doesn't separate our treatment of nature from our treatment of each other. The two are inextricably intertwined. So it realizes that there is such a thing as environmental racism, in which people of color, particularly especially blacks, but also Hispanics in this country, suffer disproportionately from being living near toxic waste dumps and being polluted and having the people who pollute them not punished, or if they're punished, punished less than if they pollute white neighborhoods. So, and that there's a connection with issues of employment and so forth. So that's very important. It's not just about saving the whales, saving the elephants and so forth, though, of course, the whales and the elephants would like to be saved or at least left alone. About our own consumption, which is critically and clearly way over the mark. The question is simply, is this making you happy? Is a life based in greed, material objects, endless consumptions of meat from animals that are tortured while they're alive, is this making Americans happy? I think the obvious answer is that no, this is the richest country in the history of the world and also one of the most miserable, which is why, psychiatric medications have gone from adults to college students to high school students to elementary school students. Now they're being given to preschool students. We're not very happy.
But is that unhappiness due to a sense of guilt from this kind of excessive consumption? I think the reason that we do consume so excessively is it's a lack of consciousness when it comes to these things. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't think it's a sense of guilt. I think the problem is that we've adopted a lifestyle which is very compatible with capitalist power and capitalist expansion and capitalist profit. It's not very compatible with human psychology and human physical health. And that if we cultivated other virtues, like, for instance, awareness or acceptance or gratitude or compassion or love, we'd feel better. Now, there's a considerable amount of psychological research that suggests that this is true. That's one reason for the psychological prominence nowadays of mindfulness, meditation, and yoga and things like that. But it's quite clear that greed and discontent and envy and wanting more and being unable to concentrate and having a kind of technology-induced ADD, these don't make people happy.
And perhaps capitalism is at the root of some of this when we look at the basic ideas of the American dream, which is kind of transmogrified into some sort of dystopian nightmare for those who care about the environment.
Yes. If you have an economic system which depends on constant expansion. I mean, the old joke is that capitalism is God, only that's G period, O period, D period, grow or die. And you have the endless increase in the size of capitalism and the endless concentration. You know, at one point there were 25 car firms in the United States. Now they're what, 2.5, something like that? So you have an increased concentration, and that increased concentration gives an enormous, a sort of breathtaking amount of political and social power to the people who control those corporations. So you not only have an economy that has to keep expanding and make environmental consequences external to transactions, so that while capitalists say they don't like socialism, they actually love socialism. They're for socialism. The socialism, therefore, is that society should pay for the pollution that they themselves cause while they themselves privatize the profits. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it is that that concentrated economic power leads to, pretty obviously, concentrated political power, so that the laws and the media, to a great extent, reflect the interests of capitalist power.
And that greed is reflected in a lot of media narratives when it comes to political issues. When we talk about empathy, I think we should all agree that humans should be more empathetic. And yet that can be a negative if you're a politician and you're apologizing, or if you're being introspective, or when a Supreme Court justice is being reviewed by the Senate. This is a hot-button political issue, which kind of reflects more of our own irrationality than anything else, I think.
Well, we've adopted a very distorted, a very limited, and often very inaccurate sense of what rationality is. Rationality becomes the culturally male model of lack of feeling, of emotional distance, of separation, of autonomy. These are not characteristics which lead to solid communities, decent families, or a global world in which we are really technologically intertwined with each other. I mean, one of the difficulties of our culture, and this is something I discuss in the book, is that the moral codes that we talk about and promulgate were created at a time when, for the most part, moral relationships were face-to-face. There was my neighbor, the people in my tribe, the people in my little village, even a large city of 500,000 people. But now we have moral relations with people thousands of miles away. Every time I get into my car and the carbon dioxide comes out, it affects people in Bangladesh. It affects people in Africa. So what kind of sense of community is necessary? What kind of interpersonal awareness is necessary for a interconnected world? And it's not just that I'm interconnected with people. I'm interconnected with trout and polar bears and redwood trees and everything else. So that takes a fundamental shift. How would we make that kind of shift? Well, there are people who are coming to see that This is part of the modern environmental movement. It's also part of the modern spirituality movement, the part that's not sort of darkened by narcissism. And the sense is we have to slow down, put the phone down after this broadcast is over, turn off the radio, and take some time to develop a sense of who we are, what's around us, what's going on. The concentrated force of advertising and now the concentrated neurological colonization of cell phones and computers makes things like doing things like that extremely difficult. So we have to swim against the tide. That's why I call it an environmental crisis, because it's not just a technological crisis or a crisis of fossil fuels. It's a crisis of our entire civilization. It's much bigger, more daunting, more complicated, but the solution to it offers some kind of hope for the future of the human race more than any other political problem we've ever faced.
It's not easy being green. Having to spend each day in the color of the leaves. When it could be nicer being red. Yellow or gold, or something much more colorful like that, like that. It's not easy being green. You seem to blend in with so many ordinary everyday things. People tend to pass you by because you're not standing out like sparkles in the water, stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring. Oh, yeah.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor Roger Gottlieb. His latest book is Morality and the Environmental Crisis. So speaking about the internet and being disconnected and yet connected in some way that we've never been before as a species, you write about the internet that, quote, the erasure of truth is furthered by the internet, including the websites designed to spread lies for advertising revenue or political purposes. More generally, it's surely a good thing that the internet takes, quote, publishing out of the hands of the wealthy. And this quote is kind of in the context of the age of Trumpism. You ask, do the followers of Donald Trump believe his obvious lies? Why don't you give the answer? Because I think it's pretty interesting.
Okay, there are too many times when Trump says obvious lies, like I'm going to sue the New York Times, or I had more people at my inauguration than anybody else, on and on and on like that.
Demonstrably provable lies.
That's right. And sort of obvious, but I think there's a sort of subterranean wink going on between him and his base. Look, we don't ask whether a warm bath is true or an ice cream sundae. We just like the way they make us feel. So the question is not, do they believe Trump? The question is rather, what do his lies make them feel? And quite clearly, it makes at least some people feel empowered, recognized, endorsed. He makes them feel great again, which they haven't been feeling too great lately. Now, this is, of course, temporary. It's based on an incredible amount of distortion. But a great deal of modern communication takes this form. I mean, there have always been lies and distortions and propaganda, but never with the volume and the penetration of attitude by modern technology. So people begin to lose a sense of the reality of truth. Now, Hannah Arendt wrote about this during the Holocaust, rise of Nazism, but it's much more true now. And think about it, how complicated the modern world is. Let's say a local bridge collapses. Well, is it because the rains were so bad this year? Is it because the government didn't have enough money to have the bridge inspected? Is it because Republicans cut taxes because they hate government and that's why it wasn't inspected? Did the original people who make the bridge lied about it? And on and on. How are we to know?
Or was it God's will?
Or was it God's will? Right. Or did the terrorist cut the support out? So it's very hard to negotiate. But people can be educated to negotiate these things, but only if they're educated to negotiate these things. If we just hand the 5-year-old, the 6-year-old, the 7-year-old the cell phone and somehow keep them off the pornography sites, but let them run wild with everything else, they're not going to do it. We wouldn't hand an automobile to somebody without training them and testing them. Yet we hand computers to them. We hand cell phones to them. In some ways, they're just as dangerous.
I think part of this is a extension of what we were talking about earlier in terms of capitalism and this ends justifies the means mentality. When you hear interviews with Trump supporters, they may kind of just poo-poo the lies and dismiss it. Well, all politicians lie.
That's right.
And ultimately, he's doing what he said he would do. So the ends justify the means to them, and so it's okay.
Yes, and I think unless they are owners of large corporations or white supremacists, what he's doing is not going to be very good for them. When they find out that, yes, maybe their taxes were a little bit lower, though a lot of lower middle class people, they're not lower. When they find out that the taxes are a little lower, but the government services, which they were getting for free, have disappeared, then perhaps they'll make some kind of connection there. Or when they find out that, God forbid, one of them has cancer and they're next to some coal mine, which was now allowed to put its refuse in the nearby streams, they may realize that, well, this wasn't a tremendously good idea. The incredible coal-centered pollution of West Virginia is going to go up stratospherically. And sadly, people in West Virginia vote for Trump. So there's a kind of blindness here. One analogy is evil. Another analogy is addiction. The very rich and powerful are addicted to their wealth and their power. And even as they are creating a world that's going to be much, much harder for their grandchildren than it was for them, and all their gated communities won't protect them. But people become addicted to a sense of illusory sense of freedom with, I'm going to drive my pickup truck, I'm going to eat meat, I'm going to buy one of 36 types of shampoo in a plastic bottle, and on and on and on. It becomes like a club, right? So in my club, in the Roger Gottlieb Club, you know, I used to be a hippie, I used to be a Marxist, now I'm a college professor, I'm pretty much vegan, I'm so far to the left I fall off the planet. So if I believe in something, well, the people in the other club who wear short hair and have guns in the back of their pickup trucks, they don't want to believe anything I say. Just because I am who I am, they don't want to believe it. Even if it's, you should pardon the expression, even if it's their ass that's going to be fried, they don't want to believe it because I'm in the wrong club. So you have the deterioration of any possibility of any kind of rational thought, which is really sad.
And as Thomas Frank wrote famously in What's the Matter with Kansas, and you point out these people aren't necessarily voting in their own self-interest. In fact, They're often voting against their own self-interest. But what I think this new age of Trumpism is demonstrating is this visceral, open backlash against the other side. I keep thinking of this quote that I read last year that it was a Trump voter who said, he's not hurting the people he needs to be hurting. I think that was very reflective of, like, we want our pound of flesh.
Right. Well, he's not serving their economic self-interest, but he is serving another kind of self-interest, which is the self-interest we all have in wanting to think well of ourselves. And, you know, if you're a straight, white, Christian community, chances are the rise of homosexual rights and the rise of women's rights, gay people, all this kind of stuff, it's extremely threatening. It just really is extremely threatening. We all thought we were great people. But now along comes these other movements and says we're not so great after all. So that fundamental elements of our own personal identity are criticized and castigated. And you combine that with economic insecurity. You combine that with the insecurity of a world in which terrorism, pretty much random acts of terrorism are part of our everyday reality. And you get a tremendous amount of fear. And fear unexpressed turns to rage, often rage against some socially vulnerable other part of your community.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor Roger Gottlieb. His latest book is Morality in the Environmental Crisis. So you're a professor, you teach undergraduate philosophy to up-and-coming engineers. I assume not all of them are the most progressive people. What happens when you get a 19, 20-year-old discussing some of these problems where, you know, you and I are agreeing here, but how do you hope that your message can help mold our future thinkers into ones who are filled with as much empathy as required to care for a struggling environment?
Well, it's not easy to change somebody's mind or to open somebody's mind. And if somebody's mind remains closed, you know, unless you get in there with a chisel, you're not going to open it. But there are a number of different things that I do. One is in my philosophy in the environment class, I have every student has to pick a tree, one particular tree, and hang out with that tree three or four times a week for 15 to 20 minutes and keep a record of the experience. And I tell them they can write anything they want, including Gottlieb is an idiot. This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And they'll pass the assignment as long as it's legible, what they write. That's the only criteria, be legible. And some of them do start out like that, but most of them, the real majority, many of them, by the middle of the term, we only have seven-week terms, they're starting to give the tree a name and say, gee, it helps me to be there. And gee, I remember some meadow I used to go when I was eight and they paved it over. And by the end of the term, they're saying, oh, well, tree doesn't look so well today. I wonder if it's acid rain that was caused by my car. Right. So there's this one single connection to one single tree, not a forest, not a national park, not an entire species, not the earth, capital T, capital E, just one tree. That's one thing you can do.
But let's say you have less time with a stranger who's sitting next to you on a plane, who's got a Make America Great Again hat on and asks if you have a copy of your book out there. And he says, what's that about? You ask a lot of open questions in this book. How do you hope that it leads them down a path of more self-reflection?
Well, I might say, if they asked me what it was about, I'd say, well, it's about moral problems, which means trying to be a good person in the face of an environmental crisis. And if they asked me what the environmental crisis was, I could give them, you know, 16 different clear, simple examples, not even counting any of the ones from global warming. And if they asked me, well, how do you know that's true? I'd say, well, if you had pounding headaches and you went to 100 doctors and 97 said you better have an operation to get rid of the tumor and 3 said, don't worry about it, what would you do? Or if the same thing was true about the brakes in your car, 97 car mechanics said, you better get new brakes, you're going to have trouble. But 3 said, no, your brakes are fine. What would you do? So you try to put it in terms they understand. I might say something like, well, do you have a pet? You have a dog. Right? Would you eat the dog? Oh, no, horrible, horrible. So, well, why do you eat beef? What's the moral difference between a cow and a dog? You know, I try to introduce them to very concrete, particular moral issues. And then if we went on from there, I'd say, well, how do we have to think about nature? Is it in terms of gratitude, appreciation, a sense of our own connection to it, in terms of wonder, in terms of religious teachings say about it? How do we get to the point where we think nature really is worth something? And then how might we change our political system to represent the interests of nature, just like we represent the interests of little children or people with Alzheimer's? How can we represent nature as part of our community and create what I call in the book an ecological democracy? And I could go on from there.
Well, I highly recommend our listeners check it out. It's called Morality in the Environmental Crisis, Roger Gottlieb. Roger, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Bluesiana Triangle and Van Morrison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.